We have all evening long been covering an unfolding story that took a very tragic turn with confirmation from Buckingham Palace tonight that the world has lost Princess Diana at age 36, dead in a car crash in Paris along with her companion of the past several weeks, Dodi Al-Fayed, one of the heirs to the Harrods department store fortune, a venerable department store fixture in London.
Welcome to Diana Solved with me, homicide cop Colin McLaren. I've spent the last 22 years investigating the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, and now I've returned to Paris with a team of investigative journalists, Dylan Howard and Aaron Tinney, and French paparazzo Pierre, to see if we can finally find some answers to the questions that have baffled investigators since August the 31st, 1997.
There were so many theories about the driver, about the car, about the crash, about everything concerned with Diana's death.
We had to wait for a very, very long time to try and get to the truth, and the truth has still not been fully disclosed.
In previous episodes, we learned of Diana's deep unhappiness during her marriage to Prince Charles, of her loneliness and alienation from Buckingham Palace, and of how the enemies she made among the royal family and in government and big business through her landmines campaign led her to fear for her life.
She thought, my goodness, this would be an easy way to get rid of me. Just sort of tamper with the car and I'll go off the road.
She sat at her desk often late at night and wrote me notes. And this letter goes on for 10 pages. And part of it reads, this is the most difficult part of my life. I fear that Charles is going to organise an accident in my car. I'm going to die of head injuries and be killed in order that he can marry Camilla.
We also heard how, by the time of a holiday with new flame Dodi Fayed in late August of 1997, the media frenzy around the princess had reached new levels of madness.
It was a penny for her thoughts. The world around her, although the penny turned into multi-million dollar business of photographing her every movement of every minute of every day.
There was a feeding frenzy which began with that picture of the kiss on the boat. The media were locked in and they wanted more. So they followed the princess all the way to Paris. They were determined to get a picture of their own. Every single photographer wanted their own picture of the princess, which would be their property.
In this episode, I'm going to examine Diana's last night on Earth to see just what the details of her final hours can tell us about how and why she died.
They should never have stepped outside the hotel that night. They should have just stayed there.
On Saturday, the 30th of August 1997, Diana and Dodi arrived in Paris after spending the previous 9 days together on the French and Italian Riviera. We're now in Paris, where we're going to retrace the events of that night as they actually happened.
I'm standing in the middle of Place Vendôme, which is a unique, beautiful place in the middle of Paris, one of the most architecturally fantastic places I've ever seen. It's also the home of the Carlton Ritz Hotel, which of course is owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed, the father of Dodi Al-Fayed, who was courting Princess Diana. Sun shining, most magnificent summer, just like it was 22 years ago, when, of course, Lady Diana snuck into this hotel with Dodi Al-Fayed. They needed to have a talk, get together, perhaps stay the night, because she was going back to London.
The couple arrived at the Ritz on their last night in their two chauffeur-driven limousines hired by the Fayeds. They went into the Ritz and they had their meal. They went up to the Imperial Suite.
Unfortunately, the paparazzi, they were onto it. And they'd come from the local airport all the way in here, cat and mouse with the paps. And then they finally arrived, finally got into the hotel. And from then on, it was all mystery as the paparazzi waited outside, as we are just now. And I'm with one of the original paps, one of the guys that was there way back in 1997, Pierre. He was waiting, looking, wondering what was going on and feeding off information from the driver, André Paul, as he was coming in and out of the hotel. giving tips, giving little teasers as to what might be happening next as the clock ticked towards midnight.
They had just arrived earlier that day from Italy, from Portofino, I reckon. And of course, since it wasn't an official visit, nobody knew why they were here. All we knew, it was only logical that they would stay here because the hotel belonged to Dodi Fayed's father. Although they didn't come here at first, they went to Rue Arsène Houssaye at first, and then they came to the Ritz around late in the afternoon. I don't remember exactly what time, but it probably was like 6 o'clock or something in the evening when they arrived here.
American tourists Jack and Robin Firestone had also arrived in Paris that afternoon as part of their European holiday.
We got onto the Channel train from London on Saturday, August 30th, and arrived in Paris on that train at about 3 p.m. And we took a taxi cab to the Hotel Castile and got there at about 3:30.
We did not know the hotel that I had booked was just a few hundred feet from the revolving rear door of the Ritz.
As Jack and Robin left their hotel that evening, they noticed the waiting paparazzi.
When we left the hotel and looked diagonally left across the street and saw this group of photographers, they weren't taking photos. It was as if though they were waiting for someone or something to happen, and they were very anticipatory. And there was a real energy about them. They were holding professional camera equipment, microphones, the whole nine yards. And they had motorcycles that were parked in front. And they just looked very apprehensive, very nervous, very on edge, and just pacing back and forth. And it looked like maybe they were making a movie.
The paparazzi represented no danger to her whatsoever. All they wanted to do was to take a photograph as she left the Ritz Hotel. Relationship with Dodi was not a secret. No one was surprised that they were there. Had she come out of the Ritz, posed for a photograph, then there is every chance, with, you know, one or two exceptions, the paparazzi wouldn't have pursued her on their motorbikes, you know, down the Champs-Élysées and into that tunnel.
Of course, being paparazzi, you had some special privileged information that was getting fed to you. I found this out later, but of course you were on the spot. You knew exactly at that moment, through information being fed to you and a few others from the driver of the limousine that was going to take Lady Diana away, Henri Paul. Do you remember that?
Yes, absolutely. Henri Paul came out of the hotel and I was sitting with a friend of mine, Serge Benhamou, another photographer. And he came up to us and started to casually talk to us and give away information to us, which was quite odd because he came in and out the hotel and he did talk to us several times. I don't remember how many times, but several times. And while he was back inside, my friend was telling me he's probably lying to us because he's the head of the security, because my friend knew who he was and his job is not to speak to us. Not deliver, you know, sensitive information.
What was Henri Paul up to? Was he trying to feed the waiting photographers false information? Or was he reveling in the attention his status as security for Princess Diana suddenly gave him? We'll analyse Henri Paul in detail in the next episode. However, for the moment, the paparazzi weren't buying whatever he was selling. And they weren't only covering the front door of the Ritz either.
This is what you do when you're paparazzi in Paris, even to this day. This is common sense. You have a venue that has a back door. Mm-hmm. You make sure you secure the back door and you put people there just in case.
To say that I like puzzles is an understatement. I love puzzles. There's nothing quite like how a bunch of small connections reveal a bigger picture. Just like true crime. That's why I like to play Best Fiends. Best Fiends is the fun puzzle adventure that you've been craving. Throughout the game, you collect adorable characters, advance the story from level to level, and you don't even need an internet connection to play. Even better, they're always putting out new themed challenges, so the game is never boring or stale. I can't put it down, and with over 100 million downloads, I'm clearly not the only one who's obsessed. It's also given me an excuse to text my family and friends since we're all social distancing. Because we all play Best Fiends, we've started to make a friendly competition. Let's hope it stays friendly after I rule the leaderboard. Start playing today. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play offline. With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. To me, true crime is like a complex puzzle that's just waiting to be solved, which is one of the reasons I love it so much. When I want to solve some puzzles that don't include true crime, I turn to Best Fiends. Best Fiends is unlike other puzzle games out there. Reaching a new level feels like uncovering a new layer in a story, one you get to take part in. I love how I have to strategically think about which fiends I'm going to play to help me win each level. The more I play, the more fun it gets. While the game is challenging, it's not too difficult, which is just right for those times that I want to unwind but still have my brain engaged. Plus, you don't need the internet to play, so it's great for any random moment where you want a little entertainment. Don't take my word for it, try it yourself. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play offline. With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
It was after midnight, August the 31st, and cameras were still crowded outside the hotel entrance. Jody hatched a plan to distract the paparazzi. He ordered the two cars the couple had arrived in to be readied at the front of the hotel as a decoy. Another car was brought in to the back entrance to enable their secret getaway.
Jody was extremely pissed off, basically, by paparazzi and what they've been doing. He came up with a plan to lure the paparazzi, in other words, exit the Ritz Hotel with no paparazzi knowing about it.
That was an interesting plan, really. This is Dodie hatching a plan. Let's think about this for just a minute. Dodie Al-Fayed's in love with this wonderful woman, Lady Diana, and he's now turning into a security consultant, hatching plans about escaping or getting away from the paparazzi who have been pursuing this couple for the better part of 2 or 3 weeks. Where is the real security manager for Lady Diana? Where is the head of security for this hotel? For the whole of this operation, Dodie's running the show. So you've got a lovesick Romeo hatching ridiculously stupid plans.
Dodie and Diana had agreed with his security at the last moment to take a car from the back of the Ritz. That was the car, of course, in which they died. It was driven by Henri Paul.
I guess you've got to really think back as to who Lady Diana was. She had the highest profile of any woman on the planet. Happens to be the most popular woman on the planet. And this plan by this man, Dodie Al-Fayed, was a nightmare.
Things were strained between the bodyguards and Dodie Al-Fayed. When Dodie came up with his plan to leave the Ritz by the back door with a new limousine, the bodyguard told him in no uncertain terms that this is nonsense and he shouldn't do it. And how do we know that took place? Because the CCTV has pictures of them arguing, but no sound.
Diana's bodyguards that night were Trevor Rees-Jones and Kez Wingfield, both of whom worked for Mohammed Al-Fayed, and not Scotland Yard or the British Secret Services. As former military men, they were undoubtedly experienced, but they had never had to deal with anything like Princess Diana before. Here's TV journalist and author of Diana, The Last Days, Martin Gregory.
Basically, Dodie had devised a plan to leave by the back door of the Ritz with Henri Paul at the wheel, and the bodyguards did not think this is a very good idea, because Henri Paul they didn't know, apart from driving them from the airport to the hotel in the afternoon, and they said we should use the chauffeur-driven limousine that we brought down to the Ritz, that brought you and Diana to the Ritz. And Dodie disagreed and said he was going to take a car from the back of the Ritz.
My inquiries way back then, 22 years ago, had it that Mohammed El-Fayed himself told Dodie that Henri Paul will drive. He will be your driver. And that's, I think, now become very clear in the different inquiries. Operation Pageant that the London police undertook some years back. I think it's become established fact now that Mohammed insisted that Henri Paul be the driver for Dodie El-Fayed.
Well, once the bodyguards were told it had been okayed by Mohammed Fayed, the argument was over.
It was to be a fatal decision.
Just after midnight, there was a movement in the hotel. El-Fayed and Lady Diana and the bodyguard and this same man, Henri Paul, did leave the hotel.
Yes.
But they left by the back way, didn't they?
Yes, through the back door.
Yeah.
Yes. So that I found out a few minutes after they'd gone, because I had... I remember somebody came back from the back door where five or six photographers were waiting and informed us that everybody had gone.
There was no need for her to leave the Ritz Hotel that night. They'd been backwards and forwards all evening. Dodie couldn't decide what he wanted to do. Diana should have put her foot down. I spoke to her that evening. She was desperately looking forward to coming home the following day. She was missing her children. She hadn't seen them for a month, which was quite normal because that's how the custody arrangements worked. She just wanted to get back to London. If she had stayed at the Ritz where they were in this enormous suite, everything would have been absolutely fine. But for some reason, a reason we'll never know, Dodie decided that they had to go back to his apartment.
So they were stalking out the back entrance and the front entrance of the Ritz. And the princess decided late at night to go and look at Dodie El-Fayed's new flat in the Champs-Élysées. Late at night, they took that fateful journey across Paris, underneath the bridge, into her final chapter.
The plan was a mess. The paparazzi knew what Dodie was up to and had men stationed at the back entrance of the hotel. Henri Paul, who was not the usual driver, was behaving erratically. And as they dodged the flashbulbs, climbed into the Mercedes and sped away, another basic, inexplicable error was made.
They weren't wearing seatbelts. Nobody was wearing a seatbelt, which was quite surprising because Trevor Rees-Jones was the bodyguard in front, and he would have had in his manual, in his training, the idea that seatbelts should be worn, but they weren't. Diana should have been wearing a seatbelt. Had she been wearing one, she might be alive today.
With Dodie's attempt to outwit the Paps already a failure, Henri Paul now attempted to outrun them.
Henri Paul had his foot on the gas and the Paps were left behind.
The last thing she saw was the Eiffel Tower lit up. And as you enter the tunnel, the last thing you see is the Eiffel Tower on the left bank.
However, at the front of the hotel, Pierre, still hoping for his own big money photo of the princess and Dodie, was also forced to improvise.
No, well, since there was a car that belonged to the entourage of El-Fayed sitting at the front of the hotel that I could see, I figured that my only chance of catching up was to follow that car wherever it was going. And that's what I did, because that car actually departed shortly after that. I did follow that car all the way up to Dodie Fayed's apartment, Rue Arsène Houssaye.
That car, with Pierre close behind, arrived at Dodie's apartment safe and sound. But there was no sign of Diana.
I could see that there was some people that were obviously with the Fayed crew or team, if you like, that were very nervous, and they were picking on their watches every 10 seconds. And so I could clearly feel that something was wrong, and I thought that they were expecting them. They should have arrived already, but they haven't.
But you got a message, a few words that made something really important.
Absolutely.
What was that?
It was the very early days of the cell phones, and as a journalist, we had some, all of us. I made a phone call to Romuald Rau, which was a friend of mine, and I managed to talk to him for a few seconds, and I remember clearly that he was in a state of panic, and I could only hear Alma Tunnel accident, and then the line shut down.
And you went there?
And before I went there, I went to the Al-Fayed people and I told them, I know something is wrong. I can see you guys watching your watch every 10 seconds. Just to inform you, I just was in contact with a photographer who was behind, you know, Diana and Dottie, and there was an accident at the Alma Tunnel. And just after I finished my sentence, they all rushed running into the different cars. I ran towards my driver, and we all drove down together into the tunnel.
After the car containing Diana and Dodie sped away from the Ritz, it headed south towards the River Seine, crossing the Place de la Concorde and then making a sharp right onto the Cours Lorraine. As Henri picked up speed, the paparazzi struggled to keep up, and after jumping a red light by the Champs-Élysées, he left them for dead. But still he accelerated, racing towards the tunnel under the Pont de l'Alma. Exactly what happened next has been the subject of 22 years of conspiracy and conjecture. But a few facts are agreed upon. The first of these is that, as the Mercedes approached the tunnel entrance at 23 minutes past midnight, another vehicle suddenly appeared, a white Fiat Uno.
Henri Paul approached the Alma Tunnel and he swerved to avoid the white Fiat Uno, but just scraped it.
It obviously did hit Fiat Uno. Whether that was an accident by the driver driving too fast into the tunnel, or whether the Fiat Uno was in the wrong lane, I can't take it beyond that. I don't know what part the Fiat Uno plays, other than it obviously had a role as a vehicle that was there.
The French investigators managed to retrieve the paint from Mercedes after the crash, although they never found the white Fiat Uno. But they know it was there because of the forensic work that they did.
And let me just say to you, in the whole of this case, which is one of the many extraordinary things about it, this white Fiat that collided with the Mercedes S280, in which Diana and Dodie were travelling, this Fiat, which existed, which left residue and white paint on the wreck of the Mercedes, has never been found. And the driver of the white Fiat, which collided with the Mercedes, has never been identified.
Seconds after entering the tunnel, tragedy.
The car careered into pillar 13 and then spun round and was facing in reverse, the opposite direction, when the paparazzi and everybody else arrived. Dodie was dead, Audrey Paul was dead.
The chasing paparazzi arrived minutes later. Some tried to help. Others, it is alleged, took photographs of the wrecked car. At 12:30, the police arrived, and 5 minutes after that came the ambulance.
We've now turned up at the crime scene, Place de l'Alma, and you arrived here 45 minutes later after the accident, but of course it was busy. And in your memory, can you tell us exactly what you recall?
Yes, so we drove down from Rue Arsène-Houssay to the Alma Tunnel really quickly, super fast. We took us like maybe 3 minutes to go. I was on one side of a tunnel where I could see the car very clearly. I could see there was already a couple of ambulances. I ran down the tunnel and I almost entered the tunnel. Only just there was a policeman at the entrance of the tunnel who stopped me and pushed me outside the tunnel. If he would have pushed me inside, I would have been arrested like the other ones, you know, like the other photographers.
This is the natural approach entrance of the tunnel.
That's
not the exit.
not the exit, the entrance perfect, of the perfect. Tunnel, which the car used.
Yes.
So I got really within a few yards of the car. So I saw the car, and that was my first shock. You could see the state of the car. It was absolutely destroyed. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked because I had never, ever seen a Mercedes in that state, ever. Straight away into my mind, I got like quite emotional. I said, oh my God, whoever was inside that car must be either dead or in a terrible shape. And then I saw my friends all lined up against the wall on the other part of the tunnel, on That's the correct. Other side behind the poles. And I had a really quick glimpse. I was there maybe for, honestly, 5 seconds before I got thrown out by the policeman, yeah? I think whoever, they had already put Diana and Dodi inside the ambulance, which were parked up in front of the car. Mm-hmm. There was two of them, two mm-hmm. ambulances, mm-hmm. I can remember very clearly. There was lots of blue lights. It wasn't too noisy. It wasn't really chaos. Mm. It was very busy, very intense.
Pierre had arrived at a scene of utter devastation. As paramedics desperately worked on saving the life of the critically injured princess, police had detained the paparazzi who had caught up with the car after the crash and confiscated their cameras and film. Pierre was able to watch the debacle from the entrance of the tunnel, and then at 1:41 a.m, over an hour after the crash, he followed Diana in the ambulance to the hospital.
It's chaos, and by then all my friends are still under the tunnel, all the paps are lined up against the wall. And then I saw all my friends be picked up in a police truck. They took them away, and then I followed the first ambulance all the way down to La Pitié-Salpêtrière.
Yeah.
I didn't know who was inside, of course. So then the ambulance was driving so slowly, and I remember I was with another photographer following, Thierry Orban, and we said to one another, whoever is inside there is really in the critical state because the ambulance should be really speeding now.
Henri Paul and Dodi were declared dead at the scene. But at that time, both Diana and bodyguard Trevor Rees-Jones were still fighting for their lives. As the news began to break around the world, initial reports were confusing.
I heard the news in London because I'd just taken my family out to the theatre and we'd come home. And a telephone call came my way from Lucia Fletcher de Lima, the Brazilian ambassador's wife, who is a close friend of the princess's. She'd heard the news on CNN. She said, ring her, Paul, see if she's okay. I've heard she's been in an accident. So I rang her mobile phone and it just rang and rang. Now, I thought that's strange because she always keeps it with her. So I went to her office and waited for news. I thought if there's going to be any news, it will come from Balmoral. And sure enough, all her staff started to gather and Balmoral told us that the princess had been involved in an accident in Paris and she'd injured her leg and her hip.
It was in the middle of about 2 o'clock in the morning and I got a call from CNN. They said that Dodi had been killed and that Diana had got out of the car but had a broken leg. And I just thought, poor Diana, she just found happiness with Dodi, because this is what I was thinking. And then typically her happiness has all been taken away again.
It soon became clear that Diana's injuries were far more serious and further complicated by a heart attack after the crash. Eventually, despite fighting for over 3 hours, all attempts to save her life proved futile. At 4 a.m. local time on Sunday the 31st of August 1997, Diana, Princess of Wales, died. She was just 36 years old.
I was just stunned, really. Couldn't believe that someone who was so sort of full of life, A, could be dead, but B, could be sort of killed in such a profoundly ordinary way. A terrible tragedy, but just so banal in a way. And that the Diana of all people should die in a car crash when she took such great care when she was driving and always wore her seatbelt, safety belt. It seemed just completely wrong. You know, I just thought, what a terrible waste.
For Diana's loyal butler, Paul Burrell, the shock and disbelief were almost immediately replaced by a sense of obligation and responsibility.
But my duty now is to take care of her. I need to get to Paris as soon as possible. I need to protect her in life, in death, the way I did in life. So the first British Airways flight to Paris was around about 6:30 in the morning. So I was there by 7:30 and met by the British ambassador. And the nurse took me into the room, and I was met by the sight of a princess lying on a bed, covered by a sheet. And I approached the bed, and it was a very warm night in Paris. And I remember seeing a fan whirring on the bedside table. And as it moved towards the princess, her hair moved, and I could see her eyelashes moving. So I took her hand and I said to her, "It's okay, you can wake up now. It's okay, I'm here." And she didn't wake up.
For others, the sense of professional duty meant something rather different.
I got a call and the phone rang and I picked up the phone and it was my agent in Paris and said, "There's been an accident," and I was dumbstruck. I was dumbfounded. I just, the first reaction was get to the office.
Diana, Princess of Wales, has died after a car crash in Paris. She was taken to hospital in the early hours of the morning. Surgeons tried for 2 hours to save her life, but she died at 4 o'clock Paris time.
She was in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong person, and all the stars collided. And she was gone. It was a perfect storm. Everything came into alignment at the wrong time. The seatbelts weren't being worn, the car was driving too fast, the driver was inebriated, they were being chased by the paparazzi. It was just a perfect situation for an accident.
In a statement, Buckingham Palace said, "The Queen and the Prince of Wales are deeply shocked and distressed by this terrible news."
My first thought was, oh my goodness, they've got everything they ever wanted. Now they're rid of her. All their birthdays have come together.
Next time on Fatal Voyage, Diana, case solved.
There's a famous bar called Harry's Bar, and I spoke to staff there. There's another bar some distance from there as well, which is a gay bar, and he wished to drink there as well. And they all said that he'd popped in during the afternoon. He'd knocked off during the sort of 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock period, and they recalling having a pastis and a different drink at these different hotels. And then he went home, and it was around about that 7 p.m. he was at home, and then he was recalled to the Ritz.
But sadly, Dodi Al-Fayed and his father, because you have to blame Mohammed Al-Fayed too, because it was his hotel and his staff, put him in a car with a chauffeur who was actually over the alcohol limit and who drove her to her death.
Fatal Voyage, Diana, Case Solved is hosted by me, Colin McLaren, executive produced by Dylan Howard, and is a production of Broad and Water Studios and Endeavour Audio. Executive producers also include Tom Freestone, James Robertson, and Andy Tillett. The series is produced by Billy Spear and written by Dominic Utton. Reporting by Aaron Tinney and Doug Montero, with additional research by me, Colin McLaren. The series is mixed and engineered by Sean Cravett, Sam Adder, and Benstown. There is so much more to this story, and you don't want to miss anything, I can assure you. Make sure you subscribe to Fatal Voyage, Diana, Case Solved, wherever you get podcasts.